at the Vicar Supervisors Conference held at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, June 6th through 10th, 1966. On the evening of June 9th, 1966, following a dinner for the Vicar Supervisors, the main address was given by the Reverend Dr. A.R. Kretzmann, pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of St. Luke, Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Kretzmann's subject, the pastor, supervisor, as a man, as a colleague, and as a pastor. He is introduced by Professor Henry Eggold of Springfield.
Been in this business, I found out just a few minutes ago, for 20 years, 21 years in the of having a vicar in his 40-year pastorate at the Church of St. Luke in Chicago. I think I could say very many things about A.R. that you already know. His list of achievements and his list of activities which he is currently carrying on with stagger, I suppose, most if not all of us here. He also carries along with grace. He can speak on various subjects, but I am sure that you will agree when I say that when everything is said and done, when A.R. has spoken, you have heard a pastor speak. He's going to speak to us this evening on the role of supervisor, as a supervisor, as a colleague, and as a pastor. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our good friend, A.R.
Has been handled all day by very capable people. How to deal with the vicar supervisor so that he looks like a man or like a colleague or like a pastor. And everybody's taken a shot at the topic at one time or another today. I am reminded of a guy who gets very nervous about these things. One of Hank's colleagues down in central Illinois talked to me. I was out visiting with my son on the campus of Urbana, Champaign, and this fellow had gone to call in Southern California, Los Angeles. And one thing that bothered him was the traffic on the freeway. And so he was asking me, what do you do about that? And I said, I don't know more about it than you do, but right across the street, he has the office of the Chicago Motor Club. Why don't we go walk in there and see what they have to say? He looked a little dubious, but we went over there and talked to this guy, and he said, oh, that's simple. He said, the main thing in Southern California is to know the freeway, how to get on and how to get off. And I said, yeah, I guess that's so, but how do I learn that? Well, he said, that's easy. You get up early on Sunday morning, get out of the freeway between 5:30 and 6. The Catholics are all in mass, the Protestants are all in bed, and the Jews are on the golf course, so you'll have free standing. So the guy goes out there, and the next thing we read in the obituary column that he was hit by a Seventh-day Adventist. The other night, some of the fellows were arguing about the death of General Sulaiman in Jordan. I think you must have met him because he gets to be the escort for everybody in and out of Jerusalem through the Lutheran headquarters. Very fine fellow. But at a reception at the embassy, and the American embassy in Jordan, when we were able to bring in 2,000 tons of powdered milk, they were having a big racket over in the corner. And Sulaiman was in the middle of it, and finally one of the embassy fellows called on me and said, "Come on over here, will you, Pastor? This little heathen is telling us that we're just chicken." And I said, "Well, it may be. What's he got on?" Well, we were kidding him about his four wives, which is a good Mohammedan. And he said, "Well, that's all right. The Mohammedans at least have the courage of their conviction. You guys are just chicken." He said, "You're really, according to your church, allowed 16. But you don't take them, you've got no guts." So they wanted to know from me, where had they slipped up in their doctrinal statements now? That they had missed the 16 business. And I, of course, was trying to think, what is this guy missing? They are. He said, "I was just over at the Episcopal Church in Amman, and they had a wedding there. And sure enough," he said, "I heard it, 16. I still couldn't figure it out. He said, "Sure, I heard it myself. Four better, four worse, four richer, four poorer." Think of it, it makes a nice balance, too. Well, the Glenwood School up in northern Illinois has one of the nicest slogans that I've ever heard. The slogan reads, "A man is what happens to a boy." And you could almost say that tonight about a pastor is what happens to a vicar. I do believe that some of the experiences that are made in that practical, crucial year is what makes or breaks some of our pastors. If they can in that year cultivate a sense of relationship to a man of God, happily, to a fellow who has somehow or other felt the call and felt the hand of God very heavily on his shoulder, it may be that some of the other things will be cut down to proper size and will be seen in proper perspective. Now, everything depends, in my view of this whole business, on whether the person is a keen person at all. He may never have to be that again in his life, except perhaps with his wife, and I hope he behaves then. But he may never have to be that again in his life. He may get into a place where he can be just as bullheaded and as thick-headed as he wants to be, never cultivate any of the graces which are a part of the gospel. He'll never have to look at himself the way others really see it. Now, when he talks about the work, I always get jittery, because we have made a noun of that good word. It is basically one of the nouns that Dr. Graepner used to hate with a violent hatred. All the Old Testament terms for the hatred of an angry God were grebbies when he found you using a verb as a noun. And work was one of his favorite ones, while other things like some of the things that he used to really sputter about were even worse than that. But you see, people have gone into the work of the church, and they made that a noun. I don't think it was ever intended to be that. It was intended to be a word of action, a verb which kept all of us moving. We've done the same thing with all the other good work. We've done it with service. And all of a sudden, service was a dedicated hour given over to worship. And it was no longer that outgoing thing which was a preparation for a genuine loving service to our fellow men. Or we have talked about love as a substantive and forgot that it was a verb of action. And for that reason, they hardly ever saw us as men. They saw us as people in position. When you started talking to the first vicars, and my first vicar is sitting over here, you see how badly used he looks. Bob Rotenberg, now stuck in the inner city in New York, at famous old Emmanuel. But because we never demonstrated what the sermon really was. See, the old Latin word for sermon was demonstratio. This was the way you demonstrated your faith. You verbalized it. You put the thing out before the people. You said, this is what I believe. And I wonder whether they always caught that. Had one of my good German vicars come back the other day. He's been supervising the German work in Mexico City and in the whole area around Mexico City now for 10 years. And he's going back to Frankfurt to take over the Auslandsdienst under the new Bishop Scharf. I think he visited down here too, didn't he? Well, Reinhard Müller was back. He talked to the Philosophie, Holland, Zali, you know, and all the rest of the celery and parsley that goes with those degrees. And we sat down, talking still about 3 o'clock in the morning. It's interesting to watch a mind like that at work. So first of all, a strong philosophical bent. The second place, some experience here in the States. And then going down in that peculiar isolationist Mexican-German outfit, which is even more isolationist than the Missouri Synod ever was. These fellows are Auslandsdeutsche. And German is not just a language, it's just not a nationality, it's their religion. They fly their daughters to Europe to get them married in Europe, or they fly guys to Mexico to marry their daughters, or they send their sons to German universities so that they get a gutes deutsches Mädel. And they have never had, in all the years of their service down there, a Spanish service. It is strictly German. Now this fellow comes back and you begin to talk with him about the values that he has found in his ministry, that type of ministry. And all of a sudden you hear him saying, I had to keep reminding myself all the time of what I learned here on Belmont Avenue. That only the little people count. That I didn't have to pay any attention to any big shots. That only the little people count. I asked him to talk about it a little further, because it was an interesting sideline. What did he mean by little people? Well, it soon came out that he meant the deprived, the distressed, the diseased people who are the main burden of our concern. In the big city, you find that those who are the quick and the healthy, they survive pretty well. But it is the beaten and the distressed people. I said, well, what ever gave you the idea that these little people were the ones who counted? He said, I don't know whether you remember it, but one day when you were alone with me on a call, he said, when we came out of the place, you were quiet for a long time. And then he said to me, we'll have to go back again tonight. And I said to you, well, I don't know whether I can go back tonight or not. And then you said, Reinhard, this is the one thing you'll have to learn, that there is no such thing as a concept of time in the mind of a dying person. Every moment is an eternity. And by tonight, our visit of this afternoon will be 2 or 3 days removed already, we must go back. They never got over that idea, that there was no sense of time left in those people. Now, if today we have to go into all the heavy things which are psychiatry and psychology, and God bless the good people who help us with their insights, I was very much taken by a subtitle on this book that just came out at the University of Minnesota a couple of weeks ago on psychiatry. The subtitle was The Purchase of Friendship. A peculiar kind of a civilization, isn't it? Where a guy has to pay $25 an hour to have a friend to talk to. But the cockeyed world has gotten so busy that they don't dare to take the time of even their pastor. How many times have you had to answer that question? They said, well, we didn't come to you, Pastor, because we know that you're so busy. And you've had to tell them that the only thing that you are busy with is people, just like you are, and just with the things that you need. And they were not too busy. Pastor Jasper said it so well today about his vicar. We are just not too busy. And this learning to be good to others, putting it as bluntly as that, when we talk to our vicars, we try to tell them, be good to the people. They look at you in astonishment because certainly this is everything that they want it to be. This is the whole ideal of their fine idealistic life. Be good to others. But that's one of the translations of be ye therefore merciful, even as your Father in heaven is merciful. But how different it sounds when you say it point blank, be good to others. That's where the excellence of our ministering to one another actually makes itself apart. We have to talk about the call and call. And here again, you have a very good verb abused and made into a noun. The vicar goes out on call. And we ask him, what do you understand by a call? And then we get into a long discussion that the only purpose of his visit is to be a voice, calling this person back, reminding them of the things they're missing, asking them if, for the love of God, they might not find something which is really worthwhile in coming back. Before we can do that, honestly, with any kind of conviction, we've all experienced our sense of inadequacy about these things, we must know what kind of people we are. I want to talk about that after a while, under the self-image of the pastor. Down here at the University of Missouri, the Wheatridge Foundation some years ago supported a man through to his doctorate who was doing a paper on the self-image of the social worker and the relationship of that self-image to the value of their work. We asked him to go on to do a study on the self-image of the pastor in relation to his pastoral counsel. The paper hasn't been completed yet, but the things that we have seen have been most interesting for all of us. I enjoyed watching the reaction on the part of our vicars as we began to discuss this self-image. And one of the requirements of the Art Institute, before they will take on an instructor besides a general self-evaluation, is that this young art instructor, or the older one, draws a self-portrait. And this, the instructors down there tell me, is the most important part of their qualification. They take a good look at that and then take a good look at the person and see whether they even came close to being what they thought they were and what they showed in this portrait. Today we've had a lot of excitement about Topeka and the poor wind that went through there. But the last issue of the Menninger's Quarterly came out with an interesting study. Up in the top of Wisconsin, there's one of these nice little family-type, cozy regular seminaries of the Roman Catholic Church, and their dean of studies went to Menninger's to take the pastoral, the clinical training course under Tom Clark and Dick Stafford, the one that all of us had to go through at one time or another. And he was so impressed with this after he'd been there for the full year that he went back and he made the recommendation to the faculty, I think Dr. Fairbairn would be interested in that, that the whole faculty should go to Menninger's. They all needed it. That went over like a lead balloon, you can be sure. But finally, he arranged that the whole faculty went out there for a 2 weeks institute. And the results were amazing. You see, the seminary had been troubled with the fact that the students weren't learning as fast as they ought to, as fast as the faculty wanted them to. They weren't learning things the way the faculty thought they ought to be learning them, and so forth. And then with Vatican II breathing down their neck and all the changes that were coming, they just didn't know what to do. So they decided they would go down and find out why in the world this thing wasn't clicking. And after having good dynamic group leaders and fine sessions in the evening, the faculty went back thoroughly convinced that there was nothing wrong with the students. It was all wrong with the faculty. Now, this is a very unpopular thing to say, I'm sure, in such sacred halls as these. But they said that they had learned this much about it, that they could now talk out their differences with one another, that they could do this in a much different spirit than had motivated them before, that they were no longer picking up all kinds of little flaws, but they were able to talk with one another in the larger picture, the real perspective on the whole job. Well, after having read that, I almost decided to go back to Menninger's too and be sure that it wasn't the vicar who was nuts, but I. And that perhaps we needed some treatment, both of us, some good therapy, in order to get this thing clear. Now, what does the vicar actually know about us as a colleague? We have, for years, I think, been sporting around with all kinds of ideas. And all of a sudden, we come up against the fact that struck Adam and Eve so terribly hard in the garden that we are naked before our God. And suddenly, if there's any decency left in us, we're ashamed. And then we start making those silly little fig leaf scriptures that they've now even put on public statues. And we try to cover up our nakedness. And you wonder, as these young people come to you, what fig leaf and what size will they be wearing this year? I find them coming to me with a variety of fig leaves. The biggest and most frequent one, seems to be a kind of a golf lot bargain basement sale, is the fig leaf of sophistication. That they know it all, they have seen it all, they have heard it all, and now the endurance contest will be on, see who wears out first, you or I. We'll see how long we can stand one another. And then this job goes on, you see, and they play with words, and they play with all kinds of things, and they forget entirely what our real job is and that we better get on with it, for the work with souls can never wait. Or we find that another fig leaf is a peculiar morality. A morality which has labeled some people as the good people and others as the bad people, as some who are in and some who are out, as some who are the liberals and some who are the conservatives. And there too, while no one would think of shifting them from their rock-bound foundation, somehow or other they have to be taught that situational ethics actually begins in the relationship of brethren with and for one another. That you understand how things are done and have to be done, and that you don't judge a brother's motives by an isolated case or an isolated instance. And their willingness sometimes to talk about the situation on faculties back at the school that they came from and so on is a good opportunity for us to tear off a fig leaf or two and tell them to watch it just a little bit and be temperate in their judgment. Or, who was the fellow who said that he had no room on his sheet for love, and not the agape kind either, but he thought it was more eros this time. And you know, that's funny. Well, we have had those people. And then they indulge in a kind of a wild living for kicks. This is a special kind of a fig leaf, which is awfully hard to handle, because usually it works right in among the young people of the congregation. And he makes the announcement, I'm on your side. You come to some of the questions which are troubling the young people, and they ask him to referee, and he said, well, I can't really speak without bias because I'm on your side. Then he advises them to come to him for counseling. When I don't happen to be around, he advises the young people to come to him for counseling because he said, of course, I have the same kind of problems that you have, and the man upstairs there evidently wouldn't understand those problems. That same young man who had that experience and that peculiar idea, I had heard about it through the grapevine, which is always working, and I took him along with me downtown to the Audie home to one session of the family court. As he walked through the hall, he dutifully two steps behind me, also in his clerical collar. After he had been solicited three times by two Negroes and a Chinese girl, in the hall to the court, walking only a few steps behind me, whom they don't solicit any longer, the guy turned up an absolutely beautiful shade of pale green as we sat talking to a Negro worker who never spared the word. She always used all the words. And this guy got sicker and sicker and finally said, could I be excused? I said, yeah, go ahead. Don't go down the same corridor. There's one over here. Now, he came to me 2 days later to say, I'm awfully sorry that happened about counseling. I had never been in a place like that. I said, you don't ever want to go back again either. This is a place where only the most hardened counselors can go. This is no place for a guy who gets sloppily sentimental or who feels that he's going to save the world by love. They've had too much of it already, and it shows them. There are other fellows who come to us wearing some other fig leaves, and there are too many to mention, but you can knock them out. There are those who wear fig leaves of speech. Old Dr. Domchek used to say, deliver me from the preacher who has heard the sound of his own voice. They resonate. Then you have to say to him as a good colleague, look, boy, cultivate the loose lip. Go like that for a while.
Don't always talk when your lips as stiff as that. Especially not when you're preaching a false.
By golly, he can sit in the office. I play with the lip a little bit, and he does it, see?
He goes downstairs, he talks to him again. This is the third command.
Now, what do? You, as a good brother, you've got to keep him smiling and so on. But he has a wife who tells him he's got a gorgeous voice. Don't let him take that voice away from you and get to be a schlabberhannes like he is. What do you do then? Then you got another problem, see? Then you got to enlist her, and that's a good technique. Say, now look, this guy is going places, but he got to get the loose lip. As you have occasion, play with the lip a little bit. Loosen the guy up. It doesn't always work. Then there are the boys, and I've had two of those wonderful fellows who are wearing the fig leaves of graduate study and overseas study,
One of my boys went away with Dr. Fearbringer's secretary 6 years ago, and he hasn't showed up yet. I said it. That's real far off in life. He's got a good wife, he's got a good job as a wonderful secretary, and so you got a cold, you have to stay out a whole semester. Wow. There are other fellows, again, off of it. The list is too long. About 25 fig leaves. You sew them all together, and it's still pretty tender stuff. It's come apart any moment. But you see, if you begin to rely on these fig leaves to be something for you, then all you can finally do is to argue about the quality of the fig leaves that you're wearing over against the quality of the fig leaves that Cyrusma is wearing. Now, there is a sort of common sense. Or whether he has more and better fig leaves than he has. And whether his would stand up better under a violent attack of theological controversy. And to get a fig leaf to stand up against that is something. And so you try with might and main to prepare the fellow for recognizing these foibles which we all have. I can remember when I thought I was going to save the entire world, especially the Missouri Synod, with youth work. And the Lord has a way of curing you by that, out of that kick, like letting you get old. You get over that one. Then you were going to cure the whole trouble in the church by liturgy. He has a way of letting you get over that, too, because your fine old ladies in the congregation talk to you about a pastor that not sent out of business schmutzy quite more. But the general idea, which is abroad today among so many of these fine boys, and they're very characterful people, is the fact that the ministry is more or less a personality cult. I don't know of anything which irks me more. Our members will try to do this to us. They will try to flatter us with a subtle deviltry of saying that they come to this church from a considerable distance because of youth. This is the devil's own temptation to pigheaded him. This is the worst kind of a temptation. And then a youngster will notice this, and he will become an imitator. And this you don't want. You don't want to make him over into a little image of you. We had cults in years past. We had the fellows who came up, and every one of them was a little vampire. Every one of them would start bellowing in the pulpit of St. Luke and lifting his right leg, and I could watch it go up, and I'd hear it come down. And then there came the later in man's life, and you closed your eyes. And then the ultimate came when one guy prayed like Lance. And he came up to the end of the prayer, and he yelled amen at God, and the mic was a little too close, and three ladies fainted. Now, did anybody ever hear an amen with an exclamation point, except that Wham produced it? But as soon as an imitator got hold of that thing, it was gravel in the throat. It was absolutely nothing anymore. Now, a fellow mustn't imitate. Then I had a fellow who thought that he was Dick Tenner. Dick stayed away at my request. Who would write his sermons on Sunday morning. He would be typing as I heard him out there, you know, I'd be in my study. What are you doing out there? Getting out. Forget it. What do you mean, forget it? I said, I'm preaching. What do you mean? You told me to preach 2 weeks ago. I said, yeah, but if you're not ready by now, you're not preaching. Oh. Well, that was the end of that talk. At least for the time being, you got to talk it out first. But he had to know, and we had to know,
that we could not stand that. That no matter how well he preached, and he was a doggone good preacher, and he's a far better preacher than I'll ever be right now, too. But he couldn't do that at that time. He had to learn that he couldn't play with holy things that way. That he had to get busy with this thing, and that was the only guy that I ever insisted on having his sermon in writing a full week in advance, so he wasn't allowed to preach. And this irked this guy because he said, I was taking away his freshness, and said, it's exactly what I want to do. You're too doggone fresh. Well, we had ourselves a great time. I don't know whether this falls in the category of letting you know that you're a man or letting you know that you're a good colleague, but it's plain everyday good sense. You just cannot stand for things like that. Then there is this whole business that I talked about before, the identity crisis. I don't know how you get through it, how you can ever survive, but we must all go through that struggle and that frustration. We finally have to decide who we are. The Savior's word helps enormously in those depressing hours. You have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you. But sometimes that isn't enough. You get strange, eerie feelings in the night. But somehow you're not making the grade, especially not in the eyes of this young fellow who looks to you to be something of a real model. He expects that the years and the Lord's mercy on those years has done something special for you. And you'd like to be something special, just for the sake of the kids. Then all of a sudden you find that you must not do that either. That you must not even try to curry the favor of another man of God. That he's got to stand on his own feet as you have to stand on yours. And that your whole personality will be belittled by an attempt just to be a man pleaser. Or to be understood. If we want that, perhaps we'll have to go at it in an entirely different way. This is all an intrinsic part of our development and our professional growth. That we finally work our way through the real step in the development of good people of God. There are some people who are totally unmoved by all the mercies of God poured out upon them. Some people who are quite sure that every blessing of God is only the assurance that they were doing it right and other guys weren't doing it quite so well. But believe me, all you have to do is to try and look again at the suffering and the tension and the distress that accompanies a real identity crisis. This feeling of an utter unworthiness to do the great things that God has called us to do. To do it, to be sure, as we've been reminded so often today, with good humor, with an understanding of our own imperfections and shortcomings, but with a high sense of call. The vocatio has got to be something brand new and shiny every morning. This is a hard thing for some of the kids to get on to. I still think I'm a little bit nuts. If we took a vote on it, I suppose I'd lose. But the fact that I have to be up at 4 o'clock on Sunday morning, that I have to be in my study by 4:30 or 5 at the latest, because I found out that I was the only guy who was violating the Sabbath law. I was the only guy who was working. Everybody else could work, but I was working. I made up my mind that this would never happen again. That I felt that I had to go to church. I had to go to worship more than anybody else. And so by the time my first services begin at 8 o'clock, I am ready for worship.
complete, utterly relaxed. Every book, every prayer, everything practically memorized, even if the lights all went out and the books were all stolen, you could still run the entire service because the thing is now a part of you. I can't get over the feeling that this is a deep necessity. But this kind of a preparation is part of our identity. Are we going to actually identify with the gospel? Make love actually the verb also, and no longer just a noun. That this imperative to love shines through, that he who loved us even unto death will not let us be anything less than his man. Then you can begin, I believe, to be a pastor for these fine young people and for their wives too. We've had the happy circumstance ever since we built an apartment for the vicars that they have taken the Lord's command to be fruitful and multiply very seriously. And every one of us has presented us with an infant in the apartment. This is very nice. This is okay. But then the poor guy gets into confusion again. Now, who comes first? My wife and the family and the work, what comes first? And what do you say? All you can say is, look, until you can answer that question for yourself, you haven't come through the identity crisis. They all belong together. There is no separation between your wife and your family and your work. They're all a part of it. And you and I are a part of it. And so we go after this thing because this is a new influence that the Lord puts into our lives, together or apart. If we ever get to the point where we're censoring or where we get quite critical about one another, where it is no longer the interest in building up one another, but simply a case of reining in the other guy, then look out, because perhaps you have too strong a self-image. Perhaps the identity crisis has brought you through with a sense of omnipotence that you have no business carting around, even in your weak little mind, that you have to yield again to the things that are good. And if we don't come through this successfully, we find ourselves so dependent upon resolution, so dependent upon action, so dependent upon actions of conferences and synodical regulations and whatnot, so dependent on things that the brethren might say, the fear of what they might say, or what would happen if this fellow reported this back to the seminary, and what would happen then to my choice and cherished image. The answer to that is a very solemn clock whoosh.
I think the Holy Ghost has a whole list of things that he just checks off and chucks out. He's got no business having thoughts like that. It just isn't worthy of it. All that you have to do is to follow what the call actually is in the ministry. To remember what you are together, the sons and daughters of the living God. That somehow, by his mercy, this is the thing that's going to carry you through and make you more than you are. And that a man is what happens to a boy. We can make this thing come true. That the man of God finally shines forth in these young idealistic eyes. To watch the eyes of your vicar as he goes on through the year. If they get duller and a little more sad, and if you find him more often depressed, move him a little closer. But when you find him getting brighter-eyed and happier and bringing his jokes into you and so on, be happy with him. Because now I think he's beginning to move out into a wider field where God wants him and where God knows we need him. And in that work, we are all blessed fellows. Join the glad adventure.
It's much more fun than you think it is, especially for the first-year people who have been ground in, nearly into the ground these days. I had so much trouble just sitting on my hands and other things during these sessions today. And every time I survey the field of these vicars and think back over them, it reminds me very much of the airport at Heliopolis in Egypt. I looked out over that field last summer, and here they were sitting. The old DC-3s that had been discarded long ago were here, DC-4s that the old trucks of the air, DC-6s, 7Bs, the gorgeous Convairs, 440s and 880s, the beautiful 720Bs and the 707s and 727 that ride on the exhaust out of their tail and so on. And you know, it reminded me of these Vickers. Some of them are just DC-3. And you can't ever make a Convair 880. They just don't move that way. And some of them are always going to be 727s with the jet laid in the back from there. And others will be the beautiful 720s and the DC-8 with their wings spread out and the jets are under the arms and in the armpits there. And so we have to take them as they are. Goodness knows they didn't all come off the same assembly line. They don't all have the deep heritage and the tremendous heredity which by the grace of God has been built in generation after generation into so many of our blessed families, but we have to take them as they are, and by the grace of God, help them to come through, to become the new grassroots people of a new and blessed generation. Thanks a lot. I hope God gives you the blessings that I have had from my vicar.
Was a lecture entitled The Pastor Supervisor as a Man, as a Colleague, and as a Pastor, delivered by the Reverend Dr. A.R. Kretzmann of Chicago, Illinois, at the Vicar Supervisors Conference, Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, on the 9th of June, 1966.